Hello, and welcome to Wiki Politiki, a show designed to bring right and left front and center, to turn the funk into function, and leave the junk at the junction. At a time when so much political discourse is heat without light, Wiki Politiki shines the light of love and truth on the darkened corridors of power, and then brings leading solutionaries into conversation to light the way forward together. Your host is Steve Behrman, author, comedian, and political and spiritual uncommentator. You might know Steve as his cosmic comic alter ego, Swami Beyondananda, or as the author of a more serious book with cellular biologist Bruce Lipton, Spontaneous Evolution. If you recognize that crisis precipitates evolution, and judging by the current crises, the chances of precipitation are 100%, this show is for you. Welcome to the Evolutionary Upwising. Now, here is your host, Steve Behrman.
Well, hello and welcome. Welcome to Wiki Politiki, Conversations for Co-Creation, where we shed the light on the undarkened corridors of power and shine a light ahead of us to where evolution is leading. Now, the purpose of our Wiki Politiki radio podcast is to bring left and right, front and center, to face the music and dance together, to address problems together, rather than defending ideological positions. Well, today we're going to speak about the unspeakable and why we can't speak about the unspeakable. We're also going to talk about our truest human nature, the original blessing of life that, I was going to say underlies, but a better word, under truths, all that is good in life. It's the foundational truth. Our guest today, Matthew Fox, wrote a paradigm-breaking book in 1983, Original Blessing, a primer in creation spirituality, while he was a Catholic priest. And that got him into trouble with those authorities and eventually led to his leaving the church and joining the Episcopal clergy after being part of the Dominican order for 34 years. Since that time, he has devoted his time and energy developing and teaching the tradition of what he calls creation spirituality, which is rooted in ancient Judeo-Christian teachings and encompasses today's science and world spiritual traditions as well. It's also art-centered, and I would have to add heart-centered. It's wisdom-centered, prophetic, and committed to eco-justice, social justice, and gender justice. Matthew Fox is also the author of A Way to God, Thomas Merton's Creation Spiritual Journey. And we will be talking about that book today, as well as Thomas Merton and his influence on Matthew Fox and on our culture. We have a lot to cover, so let's jump right in. Welcome, Matthew.
Thank you, Stephen. I enjoyed the introduction to your program. I've never quite heard an introduction like that about Wiki Politiki. It was fun and fresh. Mm-hmm.
Well, good. We think that fun will engage people at a time when people are feeling lots of things that are not fun. But let's start our conversation with the book that first captured my attention probably more than 30 years ago, Original Blessing. How did a Dominican priest end up writing a book called Original Blessing? In 25
well,
words or more.
or more. I knew something was amiss with Original Sin. I knew something was amiss. It left people spiritually exhausted and feeling bad about themselves. And about the rest of creation, it left people in despair and disempowered. Original sin does. It's bad psychology. It's bad sociology because it suggests that maybe being a person of color is an original sin, or maybe being gay is an original sin, or maybe being a woman is an original sin. I mean, it feeds into all kinds of self-doubt and political oppression, really. So it encourages internalizing oppression. It came about not with Jesus. It's not in the Bible anyplace. No Jews ever heard of original sin, and Jesus was a Jew. So that kind of struck my my interest too. What is this thing that carries such weight in so much of Christianity, but Jesus never heard of it? It was the 4th century. Augustine came up with the idea of original sin in the 4th century, and that's the century that the church inherited the empire. So if you're going to run an empire, original sin is a good idea because it gets everybody in a pretzel about who they are and where their power is, and so they get in line much more readily under that ideology. So also studying science and the new creation story, that, you know, the universe has been, and it's doing its thing for 13.8 billion years, and then it set the table for us here in this amazing planet we call Earth, and it's all been a blessing. The word blessing means goodness. It's just a theological word for goodness. So there's been a lot of good stuff happening before we arrived, and including having the table set and having the oxygen fine-tuned and having trees and animals and fruit and all the good things that we take for granted, water, too, and healthy air and ozone and all the rest. And so all that's good stuff. So why not talk about reality, which is the goodness of things, which is blessing? And, of course, the Bible itself, Genesis, begins that way, too. It talks about this was good, that was good, this was good. And when humans came along, the whole thing was very good. That's the word in Hebrew, very good. And then here we have this incredibly pessimistic, downer thing that it's all about original sin. No, get over it. You know, it's so anthropocentric, only human sin. So how could you possibly begin a religious consciousness talking about sin? Begin religious consciousness, talking about awe and wonder and reverence and gratitude, and that's original blessing.
Well, when you tell me about how the term, when and where the term originated with Augustine, it reminds me of that old saw, the difference between spirituality and religion. Spirituality is our connection to the divine, and religion is crowd control. So clearly, that was
it.
So here you were.
Go ahead. Well, I just read something this week. A woman sent me a letter. She's an AA, and she quoted Carl Jung in a letter to the founder of AA. He said that the first purpose of organized religion, Jung said this, is to destroy one's capacity for an immediate experience with God. and Bill, the founder of AA, he was very attuned to that, and he didn't want to see get into organized religion. He wanted to do his 12-step thing instead. And but I just thought that line from Jung was really, really amazing, that organized religion tends to interfere with, makes it a project to interfere with one's direct relationship with God. Well, that's what mysticism is about, and that experience, the experiential. So, yeah, a lot of organized religion puts a distance, unfortunately, between oneself.
So how was it that you... that you in your youth, chose to priesthood, going way back.
Well, actually,
what was it that had you do that?
Well, I had experiences that were very powerful for me, and sometimes in church, and sometimes reading Tolstoy and being in nature and all these other things you do as a teenager. And I wanted to explore what happened. I didn't have the language for it. It was, of course, mystical experiences. But I didn't have language for that, so I wanted to explore what that meant. Like, I remember I read Tolstoy's War and Peace between my junior and senior year in high school and in the summer, and I told a friend it blew my soul wide open, and I wanted to explore what happened to me. But, you know, now I have language for it. It was a mystical experience. But I found actually a healthy religious experience in the church in my day. I didn't know its shadow side very well, it was powerful for me, and not just, as I say, in the church, but experiences in nature and the rest, but it all kind of kind of added up for me as something worth exploring.
So you had the internal experience, and you went looking for a venue, a place where you could have more of that and you know, amplify that expression, it sounds like.
Exactly. And I found it in the Dominicans. I mean, we had a lot of meditation, and there was study, and I like study. That's a good avenue to truth. And we had a community experience, and there was the ascetic experience of chanting the Psalms every day and all that. There was an aesthetic to that. And, of course, to the Mass, especially when it was in Latin and stuff, and a tradition and a lineage. And all that meant a lot to me, yeah. And but then, you know, you start thinking, too, and you start reflecting on history and the dark stuff. And you wonder, well, now, what's the relation between this and the dark stuff? How does injustice and mysticism relate to each other? Is there a connection between mysticism, experiences of the divine, of unity, and the work of justice and injustice? So that was really my driving energy. And of course, I was coming of age during the civil rights movement and then the anti-Vietnam movement and all the rest. And so that was very much on my mind when I went to Paris to study the doctrine of spirituality. And that's where I met my mentor, Père Chenu, this French-Dominican, was very involved in the worker priest movement after the Second World War, working with Marxists. And then he was really the grandfather of liberation theology, but he's the one who named the creation spiritual tradition for me. And it is like a conversion experience when he pointed out that the two traditions in the West, one begins with the fall and original sin and redemption, and the other begins with creation. And I prefer the other, that is the creation one. And that's what I've been trying to stir up ever since I encountered him 45 years ago.
I so appreciate what is in this creation spirituality. I went and reviewed some of the points in there, and I'm trying to find those now, but they're so they make so much sense in terms of the living church, the actual relationship between what we do in our lives on a day-to-day basis and how we imagine ourselves worshiping and so on. Say more about this. Tell people more about what creation spirituality is. How do you define it?
Well, it's not anthropocentric. It doesn't begin with the human, or as Pope Francis rightly calls it, or narcissism. It begins with creation, with the universe, with existence, with the 13.8 billion years that we now know, birth this amazing universe of 2 trillion galaxies, each with hundreds of billions of stars. We're part of this. That's our beginnings. That's our matrix. That's our mother. And, of course, the Earth is a very special place that made our existence possible. So, you know, beginning with creation, beginning with cosmology, beginning with the story of the universe. Now, all tribes have their creation stories, and the Bible has its creation story, but it's only a 3,000-year-old story. And maybe 4,000. But I mean, today with science, we have a much more wonderful and awesome story of how we got here and what here is and how unique really our Earth is and our existence is. To me, this just raises the ante on awe and wonder, gratitude. And we're on the cusp, I think. You talked in your introductions about the next evolutionary step. I think we're on the cusp of realizing these things, that science is really an ally today to awaken us, to get over our preoccupation with our deficiencies, call it sin or call it what you want, Yeah, these are serious. We're capable of great evil. But we're part of a project called the universe that is full of wonder and full of accomplishments, and we're part of the accomplishment. But we have to grow up and start acting appropriately instead of beating each other up and beating ourselves up and creating games of destruction and reptilian brain games, I guess I would call them, being number one instead of being part of a community, a kinship with all creation and with all other creatures and with all other humans and all other religions and all other worldviews. You know, we have to learn how to be kin again and how to be community.
Well, you know, the Swami says that, you know, when we see ourselves as the only one, we treat everybody else like number two. So that's the part of the problem here.
That's
where,
it.
Where this
that's
anthropocentric notion. Yeah,
exactly.
Egoism.
Egoism.
And so here, yeah, and so this particular, you know, I just interviewed a couple of weeks ago Michael Dowd, who wrote Thank God for Evolution. And he says, my theology is ecology. And I noticed that ecological justice is part of the 12 principles of creation spirituality. It's like remembering that this creation is God's creation, and that's part of the original blessing that we've been blessed with.
Absolutely. And it works, or at least it used to work. It works very much in our favor to have healthy air and water and forests and soil and all those things we used to would take for granted. We're beginning to see the other side of that stuff now.
And it was free, too. Yes, it was free in those days. Now it's going to cost. But we're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about the response to original blessing and then your work and writing about Thomas Merton. We're talking with Matthew Fox, author of Original Blessing, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Connecting you with the best of the conscious minds in the world. Om Times Radio, IOM FM. Om Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. Om Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
More than 24 million Americans have an autoimmune disorder, and that number continues to grow. I'm Sharon Saylor, and I'm one of those 24 million. To put that number in perspective, cancer affects about 9 million and heart disease up to 22 million. That's why I've brought together top experts and those thriving regardless of their diagnosis to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information. Join me, Sharon Saylor, Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern, for the Autoimmune Hour on Life Interrupted Radio to find out how to live your life uninterrupted.
Are you done with the daily barrage of negativity? Ready for some positivity? Creations Magazine has been inspiring the soul for over 30 years, delivering thought-provoking and solution-driven articles, essays, and poetry that inspire you to enjoy a vibrant life. Holistic health, personal and spiritual growth, relationships, the environment, and so much more. Read us online or order a subscription, creationsmagazine.com.
I'm Fidel Nshombo. I was born in a city called the Bukavu in the Congo. We were a loving family, and then, boom, everything that I had disappeared in a single day. People think that when you are a refugee and they resettle you to America, and all your problems are done. They don't understand that that's the beginning of everything. I was not born a refugee. I was made one.
It's time we welcome refugee families with open arms. Learn more at embracerefugees.org, brought to you by the Ad Council.
Okay, Steve Behrman, we're back with Matthew Fox. And before we talk about Thomas Merton, which is really what I want to get to, I just want to ask you one more thing about Original Blessing, and that was, did you anticipate what would happen once this book was released and as you were doing your teachings? Was that a surprise to you, or were you anticipating that?
I was surprised. It was not my first book. It was about, I don't know, my 10th book maybe, or 8th book. And I'd been writing about Meister Eckhart. I'd been writing about Hildegard of Bingen. I'd been writing about great spirituality and prayer as a radical response to life and so forth. So I'd written other books. And I wrote a book on compassion and before I wrote Original Blessing. And they all got attention, positive attention. But Original Blessing kind of blew the roof off of some places, including the Vatican. They really overreacted. And I learned how deeply, deeply invested patriarchy is in original sin. For example, this was under Pope John Paul II. I thought, well, the book got translated into Polish. And I said, oh, now he'll get it. And, of course, I was utterly naive. He got even more angry when it came out of Poland. So I realized that I was really, with Original Blessing, I was really threatening them and pulling the rug out from under a lot of the ideology of both Protestant and Catholic theology that took St. Augustine at his word and in effect, have been teaching Augustine more than they've been teaching Jesus. And this, as I said earlier, original sin is an Augustinian concept. This doesn't come from the mouth of Jesus at all, or his consciousness. Now, Elie Wiesel says original sin is not only a not in the Bible, it's alien to Jewish thinking. That's what he said, alien to Jewish thinking. Mm-hmm. Because Jewish thinking is about the goodness of life and about choosing blessing, not curse, and choosing living and not dying. And so that's a strong statement from Elie Wiesel, that original sin is alien to Jewish thinking. Well, that's the same thing as saying it's alien to Jesus thinking. So what's going on here? Yeah. So I had no question about it. It was a hornet's nest. And, of course, a lot of people got on board, especially women at first, and a lot of men got their backs up about it, and a lot of male theologians, and certainly the Vatican under John Paul II and Ratzinger. But I think there's been some cooling down, and people are beginning to get it, and other theologians have kind of come on board. They haven't really gotten the full impact of it, because you don't if you don't study science, if you don't... Well, like your friend and mine, Michael Dowd, said, that theology is ecology, that theology has to place itself within the context of reality, and reality is about the cosmos, and locally, the local cosmos is the earth, ecology.
You know, I've been calling Donald Trump and Trumpism the war on reality, and when, you know, when you have these... so-called, I call them Christianists because I don't think they're really, they wouldn't know Jesus if he knocked on their door and rang their bell. It's just that this kind of like a distortion of an Old Testament God, totally bypassing the loving nature of Jesus, forgetting that Jesus threw the money changers out of the temple, and these people are bringing the money changers back in. So, this would be a really good time to begin talking about Thomas Merton, because I think he had something to say, perhaps predicting where we are today in a certain regard. Tell us about Thomas Merton. I'm sure that some people have heard the name, but they may not know exactly who he was or why he was important.
Yes. We just celebrated his centennial a couple of years ago, and Thomas Merton was born in France. His parents were artists who met at the Art Institute in Paris. His father was from New Zealand, his mother from America. So he was born in France, and His parents died while he was young. His mother died when he was six, his father when he was a teenager. And he went to school in England and then Columbia, New York. And he had a pretty bohemian lifestyle as a young man. In fact, I met a woman once who dated him at Columbia. And I said, well, what was he like? Uh-huh. She paused and said, he was a lot of fun. He loved to party. He was a great dancer. He loved talking about anything and everything. And he liked to drink. So anyway, he was a party boy and all, but very bright. And he had an aspiration to be a writer. But he had a conversion experience in the Shrine of the Black Madonna in Cuba, actually. And he took that very seriously, and he kind of threw off his former way of living. And within a year or two, he had joined the Trappist monks in Gethsemane, Kentucky. And the Trappist monks are very strict monastic order. They're not supposed to talk, and they get up several times in the middle of the night to chant and pray and all this. And so he lived that life as a Trappist monk right up until 1968. He joined in 1940 when he was 26. And he lived up to 1958 when he died. And he died in Asia because he was one of the real pioneers. Now, there are really three Thomas Martins. The first is the young man. Second, after his conversion, was the original monk. And then in 1958, after 18 years in the monastery, he was converted by Dr. Suzuki, the Japanese Buddhist, who told him to read Meister Eckhart. He said, the one great mystic of the West. And Merton hesitated at first because Eckhart had been condemned by a corrupt pope in the 14th century. But then he got into Eckhart and he shifted from being a really romantic, dualistic, and guilt-ridden, shame-ridden monk of his early years to being this prophetic Christian who really spoke out on political issues from 1958 to 1960 when he died. And he didn't just die. It's proven now that he was murdered. He was assassinated the same year that Robert Kennedy and that Dr. King were assassinated. And in fact, Merton was very close to Dr. King. He was very close to Thich Nhat Hanh, too. And but Merton was such a good writer, and he wrote a lot of books, especially the last 10 years of his life, that really woke people up to the evil shadows in our culture. So one of his books at that time was called Raids on the Unspeakable. And the unspeakable for Merton is another word for evil, if you will. And he talks about how the hubris of affluence and the lack of a sense of solitude creates a consumer culture that in turn becomes idolatrous. That everything is about what we buy and what we own. And he wrote a lot about Adolf Eichmann because the trial of Eichmann was happening in the 60s when Merton was writing, was alert, and talked about how Eichmann was made of little cells of ice. But he was considered sane. And here he was, you know, practicing how to destroy people in the most efficient way. And so he talks about how sanity itself gets lost in the process of idolatry. And when I was rereading that recently, I was thinking of this fellow that Trump has in charge of the EPA, this Pruitt, who was just accosted recently in a restaurant. And I got a kick out of it. I think I just saw this on the internet today that some woman with a baby walked up to him in a restaurant and said, "What are you doing to my child?" and so forth. He went scurrying out of the place. I love it. But I was thinking, well, that applies to this Pruitt guy who's so busy destroying his whole plan for destroying the planet as we know it so that a few corporations could get mega rich. He must have little cells of ice inside of him. And I think that that's what that lady was addressing when she accosted him in a restaurant yesterday or so. So that's part of Merton's story.
Raging against the unspeakable. Yeah.
And
she was raging against the unspeakable.
Well, she was raging against the unspeakable. Yes, she was. And she was melting with maybe little cells of ice. So Merton was a pioneer in what I call deep ecumenism, that is interfaith. like he was, he studied Buddhism and he was practicing it, and he went to visit Suzuki when he was in his 90s. And then on his last trip to Asia, he spent time with the Dalai Lama, who was only like, 33 years old at the time, young man. And Merton was 53. And they really hit it off. They hit it off so well that they canceled their meetings for the next day to have an extra day together. And a couple of years ago, the Dalai Lama was asked, do you believe in God? And he said, well, yeah, I believe in God. And the journalist said, well, are you sure? A lot of Buddhists don't use the word God. What kind of God do you believe in? And the Dalai Lama paused and said, I believe in the God of Thomas Merton. That is a pretty good endorsement for one's theology. So they hit it off very, very big. And Merton was involved in all the movements of the 60s, certainly the anti-Vietnam movement. He was coaching the Berrigan brothers and other radical, nonviolent Catholics from the Dorothy Day's movement to resist the war. And he was involved very much in the civil rights movement, and he and King became close friends. And and his murder is directly related, I think, without question, to his public stand against the Vietnam War. He came out against the war before King did, in fact. He was the first religious figure to come out against it. And there was a book that came out just a couple months ago, a really good book called The Martyrdom of Thomas Merton, an investigation by Hugh Turley and David Martin. And they really did a real investigation of Merton's death. And they proved that he was murdered, and it was a cover-up by the Thai police, by the American embassy in Thailand, because he was murdered in the retreat center outside Bangkok. And for decades, we were told, oh, it was an accident. He electrocuted himself from a fan in the room or something. But I always knew that was nonsense. And I myself have spoken to some CIA agents over the years who were in Southeast Asia at the time and asked them, did you guys kill Merton? And the first one said, well, I neither affirm it nor deny it. Second one said, well, we were swamped in money, and there was no accountability whatsoever. So even if one agent felt Merton was a threat to the country, could have haven't done it with no questions asked. And the third one said bluntly, yes, we murdered Merton. And he said, the last 40 years of my life, I've been trying to cleanse my soul from what I did as a young man working for the CIA in Southeast Asia. So I think my experience plus this book, which really goes into the details of what happened at that retreat center, it proves that Merton died a martyr at the hands of our government.
Even Wikipedia says that he was murdered. You know, and Wikipedia has the tendency to follow the mainstream.
That's very true.
Narratives, but that's Wikipedia. I just looked it up yesterday, and they said that they give a lot of credence to the idea that he was murdered, and so. You know, this is clearly the aspect of the unspeakable. We'll talk about that in our third segment. What is I know you had a connection with Thomas Merton, and he was an influence on you. Say a little bit more about that, and what inspired this book that you just wrote.
Yeah, so I wrote this book called A Way to God: Thomas Merton's Grace and Spirituality Journey, and it begins with how I corresponded with Merton in the early 60s, because I was, more mid 60s, I guess. I was longing to go and get a doctorate in spirituality, and I didn't know where to go, because I told my Dominican superiors that my generation would be less interested in religion and more interested in spirituality, and that we didn't have anyone teaching spirituality as such in our theological training. And, so anyway, they didn't know where to send me, so I wrote Merton, and he wrote back, and he said, go to Paris. And in this letter, which I kind of I share that in my book, I kind of exegete it, he goes on about Paris and so forth. So then I went to Paris, and that's where I met my mentor, Père Chenu, as I said, and where I learned about the creation spiritual tradition. So it was really a breakthrough for me. And I, as I say in the book, all the trouble I've gotten in, I owe to Thomas Merton, because I don't think my life would have taken the path it did without his proposing that I go there. So I'll always be grateful to him for not having a dull life.
Now, there was a time when he was known as a very, prior obviously to 1958, he was in correspondence with many, many, many well-known people throughout the world. That began prior to his quote-unquote conversion to Buddhism. I mean, he was, you know, a mentor to people like Clare Boothe Luce and so on. How did that change when his politics became, when he made that political switch?
Well, you're right, because his first book was his autobiography, other than some poetry he published before he went in the monastery as a very young man. But his autobiography, The Seven Story Mountain, became a bestseller. And so he became very famous, and he wrote that in 1948. It came out in 1948. So there was already a great interest in him. And of course, he was emphasizing the contemplative side of life, having being a Trappist. And of course, that was very appealing to a lot of people who had come home from the Second World War and with plenty of soul damage. And a number of them flooded actually into monasteries because of his book. And I read that book myself as a 16-year-old when I was thinking about joining the Dominicans and so forth. So it influenced a lot of people. But when you look at it today, as I said earlier, it's quite dualistic and so forth. But it's still powerful. He could really write. And it's not easy to write about spiritual experience. It takes a poet. And he had that in spades. But his correspondence was amazing. He was doing a lot of correspondence with Pasternak, with the fellow who wrote Tropic of Cancer, and Miller, who is living in
Henry
Paris.
Miller. Wow, that's interesting.
Henry Miller. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And with all kinds of Latin American poets. And this went on. It really flourished after his conversion by Eckhart and Suzuki in 1958. And he corresponded with, of course, Rachel Carson when she wrote her book, which launched the ecological movement, Silent Spring. They were in correspondence.
Okay.
Correspondence with Rosemary Luther, feminist theologian. All of it.
We're taking a break. We'll talk about...
Free your mind with Om Times Radio, IOM FM.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
Hello, I'm Lisa Berry. Join me every Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time for Light on Living, a chance to see new, hear different, and feel more as I shine the spotlight on all the ways to lighten the load of life's challenges. Light on Living is your link to that new way you're looking for, that new understanding that will enhance your life, and that positive connection that will support your growth. So join me, and you'll gain insight and start to see things in a new way that motivates you.
The Shift Network, presenting transformative programs and events to help you waken to your full potential so that together we can build the more beautiful world our hearts know is possible. Our classes support you in finding and cultivating your gifts and in bringing those gifts to the world to create tangible change and connect us as global citizens. Go to theshiftnetwork.com or follow the link on the Wiki Politiki sponsors page.
My name is Meera Batra, and this is How I Live United. Many families have come to America for a better life. I advocate for these families with United Way. United Way empowers them to see opportunities available. We help them get involved with their kids, schools, and network within the community. My name is Meera Batra. I help families see opportunity and succeed. I don't just wear the shirt. I live it.
Give, advocate, volunteer, live united. Go to liveunited.org. Brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
Thank you.
Okay, Wiki Politiki, and we're back with our final segment in talking with Matthew Fox. And we're going to speak about the unspeakable this time. I first heard that word and phrase and, again, tracked it back to Thomas Merton when I read the book by James Douglas, JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters. And, you know, and James Douglas also having the same, also had Thomas Merton as a mentor. And you see that there's a lot of spiritual, political courage in people who can stand up to and speak out about these perpetrations that I think have put the body politic into such severe PTSD and dysfunction. So, how do we deal with this evil? And again, evil is a term that I know a lot of people on the progressive side, they don't like to talk about evil. Perhaps there's a kind of moral relativism or whatever. But I want to get an idea. What is evil and the unspeakable? And what do we how do we face that as awakening people now?
Mm-hmm. Well, I did a major book on evil. It came out in a new edition just last year. It's called Sins of the Spirit, Blessings of the Flesh. Transforming Evil in Soul and Society. And for the new edition last year, Deepak Chopra wrote a foreword, and in it he had this interesting sentence. He said, evil is the number one question, number one issue in 21st century spirituality. And I thought that was very powerful, especially coming from Deepak Chopra, because he tends sometimes to sound kind of new agey or over happy or something. But he is a scientist. He is a doctor. And I was really struck by that one sentence and by his willingness to write a foreword to my book. And I think that you're right, that Merton was daring to lay bare some of the foundation of evil. And what I try to do in my book is to come up with a new language for evil, because I think one reason we're reluctant to talk about evil is that we don't have a language, that religion has so oversold sin that we think, oh, well, we're gonna drop that from our vocabulary, fine. But the truth is that evil arises. And as Deepak Chopra points out in that foreword, he says that, even though millions are leaving organized religion, the world is not getting better. And he says, we just, by the skin of our teeth, escaped, complete destruction in the 20th century with nuclear war possibilities, et cetera, et cetera. Now we face these other issues, of course, of global warming and the rest. So his point is that evil is deeper than my point would be that evil is not the same thing as sin. It's something bigger. I think the opposite of evil is not the bad, not the good. The bad is the opposite of good. The opposite of evil is the sacred. Now, this word, the unspeakable, I think in many ways the sacred is unspeakable. This is why when we have experiences of the sacred, we either go into silence or we go to music or dance, or some other art form to express, try to share what's happened to us. And so I think the word unspeakable has two sides to it. The divine is unspeakable. It has no name. As Eckhart says, God has no name and will never be given a name. Superessential darkness is who God is. But also, Merton is saying that evil is this unspeakable thing because we don't want to talk about it. We just want to do it. We just want to do it, and preferably in secret, you see. And this is why you need good journalists. This is why you need good radio programs like this one to stir up the silence that people want to wrap evil in. People don't want to know. Eichmann didn't want people to know what he was really doing, and neither did many. So, evil is – there's a great sentence from Marxist philosopher or psychoanalyst who I quote in Eric Fromm, in my book on evil. He says, necrophilia grows when biophilia is stunted. Necrophilia grows. Love of death grows when love of life, biophilia, is stunted. And I think that's a pretty darn good definition of evil. It's necrophilia. But what's neat about it is it also gives you the medicine. The medicine is there. If you can grow biophilia, necrophilia will be diminished. And that's the heart of it, I think. Are we loving? And it's Deuteronomy says that. I put for you living and dying, choose living. Are we choosing the living or are we choosing the dying thing? And, of course, that's where Merton talks about this idolatry, this what he, secular consumerism, he says, is killing us. And it's subtle. It sort of has to be talked about.
Now, we have this new word, situation, in front of us where yeah. we have an entrenched power that is freely willing in terms of exploitation of the planet, in terms of discarding human beings and treating them poorly and so on. And we have a core, I would say, a solid 30% of our population behind that pretty much fully. How does a society in our position right now, how do we mobilize the other two-thirds of us around something that is more like biophilia than necrophilia?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's certainly the question of the day. And obviously, things like happened this weekend, the protests about the immigration excesses, ripping children from their parents and so forth, that has to be loud and it has to be in people's faces. And I remember I went to the protest in Vallejo, which is not a big city, but it was first half hour was Ohlone people, the indigenous people of this area, are doing a dance and chanting and so forth, bringing in the sacred, you see. You've got to kind of gear up because evil is not just a thing. There's a spirit dimension to it, you see. And you know that because it keeps coming back. You don't kill it. Martin Buber said that. You don't clash out evil. You have to convert it. You have to transform it into another energy. So the drummer, the leader of this Ohlone tribe that was dancing in Hawaii, he said, I'm so happy you're all here, he said, because when they did this to our people, to our ancestors, no one showed up. It was really powerful. I have goosebumps there now repeating that. No one showed up when they took our children away from us and put them in boarding schools hundreds of miles away, etc. They ripped our children from us and from our culture and from our religion and everything else. So he said, I'm so glad that you're all here, that we're not going to repeat this and that we're going to fight for these children. So gathering, of course, finding allies, and of course, getting people to vote, getting people to run for office, getting people to go on programs, radio programs and the rest, to and writing letters to editor. And you just have to stir people up. But we can't underestimate, it seems to me, the dire time that we're in. And this whole Supreme Court thing is really, really scary. People have to realize that, we're part of community. We're part of one another. What others suffer, we suffer. And I may not be a woman, but that doesn't mean that I have a right in men determining what women do with their bodies. And it goes down the line. I'm not black, but as another human being, I should be fighting with black people and other people of color, who are asked to live second class citizenship and so forth. So the issues are so dire, and of course the planet itself and climate change, that we're on the verge, number one, of killing American democracy. I think Citizens United was really the biggest moment in the death knell on democracy. We have to fight all that stuff. There's a lot of things to be fighting, and of course it's exhausting, and you have to have an inner life. You have to find the balance between finding your personal balance and peace and you're fighting for peace and justice in society. It's a dance we all have to get used to today.
You know, and I think that largely the progressive movement since the civil rights movement, since the anti-war movement, has been a secular movement. And Rabbi Michael Lerner has pointed out in his Left Hand of God book that when people were feeling spiritual malaise because of this consumerism and so on, that there really wasn't that much spiritual nourishment on the left. And you know, the right-wing Christian fundamentalist churches kind of stepped into that breach. And so when people these days, when they want a religious experience, although now there's plenty of people turning to the East, but mainstream America will turn toward that kind of Christianity because it provides answers, it provides a community, it provides a sense of perhaps the original meaning of religion, religare, to bind us to something that's bigger than ourselves. So I just wonder at this point where the touchstone of progressive spirituality can spark the love of life and the love of creation and this original blessing, so that we take some of that territory from that's been misappropriated, I would say.
Yes.
Does that make sense?
I agree. Absolutely, I agree. And it really doesn't make any sense when you consider that King came out of the black church. He was an explicit Christian. And Gandhi, of course, was deeply spiritual and a practitioner as a Hindu and so forth. So to secularize the justice struggle is really, there's very little historical proof that this works. But the one thing I'm involved in is a new kind of order. We call it the Order of the Sacred Earth. And it is about people gathering to take a common vow. The vow is, I will be the best lover of Mother Earth and best defender of Earth that I can be. That's the one vow. And you can come from any tradition or none. And we had a ceremony on the solstice, and about 80 people showed up, and including an atheist woman, a young woman, 28, who was atheist. And she said, I agree with this value, and I want to join too. And that's what you're talking about, the need for community and the need for shared values and the need for our kinship in allies in our struggles. So I think that this idea of an order today makes a lot of sense, because we're between times as far as organized religion goes. Some people can still derive something healthy from it, and others have given up on it. And but an order that is not bound to any one religion, which is what this Order of the Sacred Earth is, it's not bound to any one tradition, this could be a gathering place for a lot of people, young and old. And the leaders in our, as we get off the ground, are two young people, a 28-year-old woman, a 33-year-old man. And they wrote this book with me called The Order of the Sacred Earth. And we also have other people's essays in there, including David Corton and Brian Swim and Amir Vistar and others. But we're launching this actually in July. The book comes out officially July 17th. And I'm excited about
it because I'll be happy to interview these people.
There you go. Well, you should. Yeah, they're kind of local. And
I know. I met them a few weeks ago.
Oh, there you go. You met them. Great. Yeah, I think that's, to me, it makes sense, because an order is a much simpler thing than a religion. And it can travel lighter. And yet it's
focused. I'll take a double order of that order. I'll take two orders to go.
There you go. You're so funny with language. I love your alacrity with language. That's wonderful. A double order of the order. Good. Great. Yeah, you interview them one of these days. They're ready to go.
It's exactly what we need, because something needs to unify us at the level of sacred that's bigger than religion and non-religion. And the fact that your atheist said, I'm in with this order, is an indication that we're in the process of evolving from children of God to adults of good, because, you know, we all know, even though people haven't seen God, we've all seen good. And I think that that's probably, Plato really nailed it, that the truth, beauty, and goodness as the expressions of love. And I haven't found a better way of seeing that ever. And I know Rudolf Steiner echoed that idea as well. So the tell us the name of that book one more time. The Order of the Sacred Earth. What's it called?
Right, The Order of the Sacred Earth. Mm-hmm. And and it's coming out July 17th. And I couldn't agree more that we do connect to the power of the sacred, and that has everything to do with the earth. That has everything to do with creation. And Merton wrote about that. The sacred is our connection to the creation.
Thank you so much, Matthew Fox, for an amazing interview. Yeah, and we're looking eagerly forward to the... Okay, I did too, and I'm sure our listeners did. This is Steve Behrman, WikiPolitiki. We'll be learning more about the Order of the Sacred Earth when it comes out July 17th, 2018. WikiPolitiki, until next time.